Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Today on Rambling About Cars, we drive the new 2024 Ford Mustang. We tease the new U.S. spec Toyota Land Cruiser. We discuss the new Mitsubishi pickup truck. We discuss Honda S2000 electric rumors. Yet we've heard them too. And folks, our first ever $1 million cheap car challenge is tonight. So let's roll. It's podcast time. I am Christopher Smith. Mr. Chris Bruce is across the way, and we are not alone. Why don't you tell everybody who we've got with us today?
We have got Brett T. Evans, Motor1.com senior editor, with us tonight. Brett, go ahead. And the folks know you. You've been on this, and you've been on the Happy Hour many times. But if there's anything you want to say, go ahead and feel free to say it.
My favorite color is baby blue. Brett Evans from Motor1.com.
That's totally appropriate. Yeah,
that's fair. Baby blue. I'm a big fan of blue myself. We can work with that.
Sure.
As we give people just a few minutes to jump onto the program, we do have a nice, I feel like we have a really nice varied program because we've got cars, we've got SUVs or SUV, got pickup truck.
Wait, I so this is the thing. Since we're waiting for people to come on and waiting for people to show up in the room, I think this is the perfect opportunity for Brett to talk about his project vehicle. His
that
project
you can
SUV,
read about that you can read about at Motor1.com.
I will pull that up right now. Brett, why don't you tell us about it a second?
It was a kind of a weird happenstance. My brother bought a 1996 Lexus LX 450, which is the 80 series Toyota Land Cruiser, on Cars and Bids a few months ago, and it was local to me, so I went out and picked it up for him. And when I got there, it just wasn't in the condition that it was described. And so we talked to the owner, and the owner gave him some money back, but it kind of just soured the whole experience for him. He just was not. So I drove it home. He owned this car. It was his. Yeah, there it is right there. He'd already purchased it. And so I drove it home, and on the 90-minute drive home, I was like, I really like this thing. My boyfriend was following behind me, and he drove it around the block a few times, and he felt the same way. And we're both like, shoot. I mean, we were looking for a car to kind of do a little bit more camping and you know, hiking and stuff like that. So we thought maybe this is the one. So we bought it from my brother and kind of have been on the process of baselining it. So it's not going to be a big full off-road overland build. We're just going to kind of get it to a baseline daily driver, you know, reliable, comfortable kind of level. And it's been a whole lot of fun.
Nice.
So far, very cool. So far we've had the mechanic take care of the front axle needed to be resealed. So we had a mechanic do that as well as do the oil pans. And then a couple weeks ago, we just did the valve cover gasket and spark plugs and some of the supporting maintenance there. And then, This latest installment that we have is on tires. We got a new set of Firestone Destination tires on it that honestly, compared to the 12-year-old rubber that was on it, transformed the way that it drove. It's amazing. You can't compare old and new from a traction standpoint, or you can't compare the tires before and after just because the old rubber was so terrible. And so now people sometimes say, what's a good tire to buy? And I'm like, whatever it is, just get new ones. If your tires are old, just get new tires.
Oh, that's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. Go ahead.
I mean, I don't know what your tires look. I don't know how old your tires are. These were 12 or 13 years old, and they were dry rotted and cracked. And I put these Destination XTs on it. They're a much more aggressive tread pattern. So I was expecting them to be louder and to ride worse and everything like that. It was amazing how much better the thing drives with new tires on it. So It's been a fun project.
I'm with you 1,000% on getting the new tires. And for as long as I've been alive and as many cars as I've owned in that time, I am still at this point amazed every time I get a new set of tires because it always makes such a big difference. Mm-hmm. But I've been hanging around Jonathan Benson too long from tire reviews. I've gotten to the point now where it's like, ooh, not just any new tire works. There are amazing differences just between brands. Not that my 2004 Subaru Forester is the off-road superstar that this Lexus is, and this thing just looks amazing and awesome in every way. But last weekend, I finally had a chance to really kind of exercise the Forester in some off-road conditions where I was going down some pretty sketchy trails, and I was in some pretty deep sand at some points. And I have a set of Falcon Wild Peaks that I put on it earlier this year. And yeah, they're awesome.
I've had Falcon Wild Peaks before. They're great tires. And that's agreed. That's a great car. I know tons of people who get into really, like, my favorite thing in the world to do is to drive up a trail that feels really difficult and challenging and then get to the top and there's a bone stock Subaru Outback up there. Like, I love it when that happens. So those are tough cars.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to Moab anytime soon, but I felt very vindicated because, I mean, it's a small, fairly light all-wheel drive. I mean, I don't have locking diffs and all of that stuff. So if things get really, really squirrely, I would run into trouble. But at my age, if I reach that point, I'm just calling AAA, like, just come on here with your truck. Tow me back to where I can get some traction.
So, quick teaser before we move on to the news. The Lexus LX is the cousin, I think it would be fair to say, maybe step sibling to the Toyota Land Cruiser, and we will be talking about the new Toyota Land Cruiser here in just a little bit. So stay tuned.
I was comparing dimensions and they're actually very similar, so I'm very excited for the new the new Land Cruiser, but the new GX. Dimensions between this, my LX, and the new GX are very similar, so I'm pretty stoked for what the Land Cruiser is going to bring to the table.
Yeah, cool. Well, I mean, it's like everything else over the years. The cars have gotten a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. So I'm pretty stoked too to see how the new smaller Land Cruiser, if you will, is going to fare here for the United States. And just a quick shout out. We're live right now. If you're listening to us, you know we're live right now. Motor1.com on Facebook, Motor1.com on Twitter, Motor1 on YouTube. And if you can't catch us live, the podcasts go up on all the audio platforms. Apple, Amazon, Deezer, iHeartRadio, something. Like a dozen or so audio platforms. They go up every Friday, 10:30. They're always up by 10 or 10:30 a.m. on Friday. We'd love to have you live because you can comment. You can jump into the comments. Join us in the chat right now live. And with that in mind, we're about to talk about the 2024 Mustang. And we don't have new news because this thing debuted almost a year ago. But
no, we have new news in the fact that Brett actually got to drive one.
And yes, the drivers are finally.
A coworker of ours, he is the first guy I've known to get to drive one. And he is certainly the first person on the show to get to drive one.
Right.
So it's been a long questions for him.
It's been a long buildup. I mean, the car debuted last September. And I mean, we're finally getting around to media drive. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, we're on the bad list or anything. It just took this long for the media drives to commence. So Brett, I know there's been, and Bruce, if it's okay, I'm going to take the jump here because I'm a Mustang guy. I've got one in the garage.
Man. Go for it.
There's been considerable discussion since the 7th gen came out that, the 4 says it's all new, but it's kind of really not. It still pretty much has the same bones underneath. There's some fresh styling on the outside. Does it really feel like a new generation Mustang? I think that's the first question that people want to know.
There's definitely a lot of commonalities. The suspension layout's very similar. You know, most of the body mount, the hard mounting points are the same. So there's obviously some similarities when you really get structural. But No, I mean, you would never, if you weren't an anorak looking for those details in a Mustang, you would never know that it wasn't a brand new, all completely, totally revised from the ground up generation, because Ford has just done so much to differentiate this car. The comment that you just had pinned was really, yeah, there we go. That was, that's really prescient. I mean, how vastly different the interior experience is compared to the previous generation is, I mean, it's astounding. It's so much more modern inside there, for better and for worse. I agree with Ted Adam Green here that he doesn't miss the dual arcs. I do miss the dual arcs. I kind of miss that twin cowl design, but Ford is being very bold and being very like modern with this new car, at least in everything that you interact with. It's all very modern and updated.
For the listeners out there, let me just read the comment. And this is why you should jump on and join us live, because you can comment live and interact here. Ted Adam Green, longtime Rambler. Awesome. Always, always, always to see you. Ted Adam Green says the new interior is asymmetrical, but so was my Fox body Mustang. So I don't miss the dual arcs in the cockpit. That's what we're talking about with the dual arcs. Of course, the new Mustang, very asymmetrical. You've got those screens in there. Brett, did you get a chance to drive a car with the single, you know, with the two screens behind the one glass and then the screen separate? Because I know when we finally saw one of the lower spec Mustangs that had the driver display and then the center display separate, it looked kind of awkward.
We didn't get to drive one of the ones with the base layout. They did have one for display, like sitting in the hotel where we were staying for the drive. They did have one set up for display. It doesn't look nearly as integrated as the flagship spec one does, but it's not terrible in person. It doesn't really look any different from the most of the other premium cars these days that have a similar setup. So definitely, still kind of stands out, still shows that, like, you know, base Mustang buyers are still going to get a much different experience than they ever have in the past. That's just like loaded with customizability and technology.
And so, I like the comment. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to call this out from frequent commenter Grupa FBC, who, Brett, he is from Australia. And he commented, the Fox body instrument panel graphic option is not only fantastic, but it shows how much simple clarity and visual communication is missing from current displays. And were you able to experience that? Because obviously the new Mustang has multiple display options on its digital instrument cluster. And one of them is kind of the throwback Fox body look. Were you able to take a look at that?
Yeah. And it looks exactly like it does in all the photos that you've seen of it. It's really, really cool. It looks just very, you know, understated and sleek. And the coolest part about it is, even though the display is, it's a digital display, it's already lit up. So it's not like the display needs to change. But when you do turn on the headlights, when you go, like, you know, when the sun goes down, the illumination behind the gauges turns green, just like it does in the Fox box.
That's a nice touch.
Obviously doesn't need to, but it does anyway. Right. And it's just kind of a fun thing that Ford is doing to kind of really bring it back a little bit.
That is a very fun touch. And I love how the tachometer, you still get like that, the yellow zone, like you're getting close to red line. The yellow zone comes in at what, like about like 5 or 5,500 or so. And it's like, the engine still has a long way to go on this guy. The Fox with the old 5-liter push rod, you were getting close to the limit, but not with this one. This new Coyote, what, red lines at 7,500, I think?
75, yeah. It's an out, like, for being not a particularly exotic engine, it is an outrageously high revving machine. It's crazy. You can also tell in these two photos, you can tell that there's a hatch mark on the 55-mile-per-hour mark as well, which I love. That's so
adorable.
That is ultimate 80s right there.
Yeah.
For the younger listeners out there, back when the United States had the nationally mandated 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, I believe it was required by automakers at that point to highlight 55 miles an hour in the instrument cluster.
And I believe there was also an 85 mile per hour speed limit. You could not have a speedometer that went over 85 miles per hour.
Right. So the cars could go faster. Granted, in the 80s, not necessarily much faster. But that's why you see 85 mile an hour speedometers from that era. that's all automakers were allowed to put on there. So, I mean, the running joke was, it's like, yeah, I don't know how fast I'm going. It's like 3 or 4 inches past 85, right?
So we always like to call out new commenters, and Cola, I don't think we've seen you commenting before,
welcome,
if I'm mistaken, but yeah, we love to call out new commenters. So Cola said, new Mustang is very good overall. Keep the segment alive. But this new gen is a major upgrade. Overall, I guess people have no choice since the Challenger, Charger, and Camaro are all dead. So thank you, Cola.
You know,
we'd love to get comments, especially
thanks
from new listeners.
Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Rambler family. This isn't the first time the Mustang has been solo. 2002, no. The Camaro was the last year for the Camaro for a while. And then you had the tail end of the new Edge there, 03 and 04. And then you had all the way up from 2005 up through 2009.
Sure.
Where the Challenger came back in what, 08, somewhere around there? You had the Challenger.
It was earlier than that, wasn't it?
You had the Challenger and the Camaro come back pretty close together. So there were a few years where the Mustang had everything all its own.
06 in my mind.
It could be 06 or 07. It could be earlier than that. I think you're right.
I was in high school when they first came out. So I think it was 06.
I think you're right. You were still in high school in 06. Damn it, Bruce.
I was still in high school. Well, you and I are 10 years apart, buddy.
Yeah, 10 years apart. It catches up to you. But yeah, point B, there were a few years the Mustang was solo, and it didn't suck. So
No, it didn't.
Hopefully Ford won't be like, yeah, we won this one, and kick back and just let things go like they've done from time to time.
It's funny because it kind of seems like Ford does their biggest leaps forward with the Mustang when they're in
competition. I know, right?
Like the 2005 Mustang was a big, it finally did away with the Fox chassis and all this other stuff. And it had no competition. Ford had no reason to keep the segment that vibrant and interesting in 2005. So, you know,
and even prior to that, you know, you had the 03, the SVT Cobra that up to that point, the Camaro was just kind of reigning supreme in the power world. And Ford, they finally decided to put a supercharger on the Cobra, and then they underrated it. So that it was like about 425 horsepower. It was rated at 390, just as the Camaro went away. So yeah,
it was a 12-second car in 2003. It was nuts.
Those things were insane, just insane. But speaking of power here, tell us a little bit about your driving experiences. We've talked to you about the aesthetics. What is this thing like to drive? Because I've heard lots of reports on the steering. Do you have
specifically?
Tell us a little bit.
Which models did you drive?
Yeah.
Did you not drive? Because obviously there's the GT, there's the EcoBoost, there's the Dark Horse, etc.
I've got a squeaky dog. Hold on. Just a second.
Nothing wrong. No, keep going. Okay. We love squeaky dogs.
We'll get Cooper in.
If you want one?
We'll get Cooper in on the discussion.
Yeah, he's over there.
I actually drove pretty much all four variants: EcoBoost and GT, Coupe and Convertible. So
No Dark Horse, no Dark Horse, right?
Okay, no, we've got Jeff right now is driving the Dark Horse.
Yes,
and he'll have impressions next week. So be sure to keep tuned to Motor1.com for that. But
sure.
So I drove all of them, and you know, from like an all-around driving enjoyment perspective, I actually really enjoy the EcoBoost Coupe a lot. Like it's 250 pounds lighter, and most of that weight comes off of the front axle, so it really feels a lot more nimble and a lot more like the steering is much more direct and everything like that. But they all drive really nicely. They're all very, you know, very enjoyable, sporty, you know, plenty of power, obviously. And it was a really kind of like a comprehensive, good driving experience. I think I heard you inferring a little bit that there were some problems with the steering, and I definitely think that that's true. I think I noticed it especially on the GT convertible that I was driving, that the steering feels way overboosted. It's a little too light. Doesn't really require very much effort. It's really direct and it's really quick. The steering ratio is quicker than it was for the last Mustang GT. So that's nice that you kind of get a lot more direct turn in and everything like that. But feedback, there's no feedback whatsoever. And kind of in the middle of a corner when you feel like the most weight transferring and the most G's and everything like that, that's really where you want to know exactly what the tires are doing. And the Mustang just doesn't communicate that to you at all. So from like a dynamic perspective, that was my biggest complaint. Otherwise, though, it was just kind of like a very enjoyable and fun driving experience. The sound of the engine alone is worth the cost of entry in my mind. Like, it just is such a brilliant, that 7,500 RPM red line is incredible. And the thing just shrieks all the way to the top. Like, I would never expect. I mean, this thing's a cross-plane crank. It's not supercharged. And it just screams. It's an absolute wailer all the way to the red line. It's so brilliant. And it sounds so good. So that was obviously just a really exciting and enjoyable driving experience right then and there without even needing to turn a wheel. And it really is just a really enjoyable, fun sport coupe. I probably wouldn't put it in the same category as like a, you know, BMW M4, but it's also not nearly as expensive. It's not fighting for the same enthusiast heart as something like that would be. It's brilliant. It's a great little sports car for sure.
So if I can play devil's advocate for just a second, do you think that maybe Ford set up the steering, especially for that convertible GT that you were talking about, that they set it up more of kind of an overboosted setup because it would be more comfortable for, you know, someone who's not going to take this on the track, someone who just, you know, it would be a grand touring cruiser that you would just kind of take around, something like that. Do you think that's possible?
That was my suspicion. And I sat down with a Ford engineer at dinner after a drive. And I asked, so the cars that I drove a GT with the performance package and then a GT convertible with the performance package. And I asked if the tuning is different, suspension and steering between the convertible and the coupe to account for greater weight, you know, less structural flexibility or less structural rigidity, everything like that. And he said that they were actually tuned pretty much the same, that they don't really do body specific.
Really?
And they do that because they think that the structure of the convertible is stiff enough that it can kind of cope with the settings for the coupe. And that's not entirely true. You definitely see some cowl shake in the convertible. You can kind of see the windshield header wibbling around a little bit over really bad pavement. But, you know, it is still a pretty like the car itself, you know, beyond the windshield is a pretty stiff structure. So I kind of buy the marketing speak there a little bit. To be fair, I didn't actually experience that much of a difference when I was driving the coupe, you know, hard and fast.
Oh, okay.
It felt a little bit more direct for sure. Like when you turn the wheel, the action happens more immediately because there's less flex in the body. But,
sure.
The weighting felt very similar. There was, you know, a similar amount of feedback, which is to say not very much through the wheel. But I really do think that, like, you know, to your point, Chris, I don't think that many average Mustang customers are going to care that much about how much feel you get through the steering. There's going to be a Shelby version coming soon. I'm sure of it. They haven't confirmed that, but I'm sure that there's going to be a Shelby version coming soon. There's still the Mustang Dark Horse, which Jeff drove today, and we get to find out what he thought about it in a couple of days. There's all these, you know, potential variants for people who do want really direct, really, you know, precise, lots of feedback, everything like that. And for them, there's those cars. But for the average person who just wants a really fun, enjoyable V8 soundtrack and, you know, in my opinion, very attractive, very like Mustang appropriate styling, I think the GT and the EcoBoost are both great options.
You know, it's a great point as you're talking about various trims. I mean, we are at, I mean, not to say that a $50,000 six-speed V8 for an engine rear-wheel drive car with 480 or 486 horsepower, depending on if you get, that's not entry level, but I wonder if Ford is leaving room for like Dark Horse, for Shelby's, for other vehicles like that, to offer that more connected experience. It sort of reminds me of when the C8 Corvette first came out and people were like, oh, this thing has a bunch of understeer dialed into it, you know, and this is not a very good car. And it's like, well, the entry level, the base C8 Corvette Stingray is the car that the people are going to buy. They just want to drive around and say, I have a Corvette. And a lot of those people may not have experienced a mid-engine car before that has a very different driving dynamic from the Corvettes they're used to. So, you know, dial in a little bit of safety. I'm curious if that's the case here, but to jump back to the convertible having pretty much the same tuning and they feel it's stiff enough, I'm just thinking, now granted, my Mustang in the garage is much, much, much older, but the first thing I did when I got that car was get a set of frame connectors welded underneath. And don't you think it made all the difference in the world? Sure. It's still probably the best mod I've done so far. And I'd be really curious to see how a new convertible feels with some extra bracing underneath it.
I agree. I think that would be kind of an interesting experiment to kind of like use some of that old school hot rod tech to try and bolster up a new car to see if it makes as much of a difference as it does in the older stuff.
I mean, when you lop the roof off, you're losing something there. I feel like there has to be something extra added.
I'm sure they add more, you know, there's probably an extra X brace and the rear seats don't fold down as they do on the coupe. So there might be some bracing.
So some extra bracing in there for sure.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, my mom has a 2008 Mustang convertible and she bought that while I was working at a Mercedes dealer, and I would drive, you know, in very quick succession, I'd go from her Mustang to like a 2008, 2009 CLK convertible. And the difference, like her car was much stiffer than even the Mercedes's were of the era. So I think that Ford takes it pretty seriously, you know, at least with the post-Fox chassis era. I think they take, you know, structural rigidity a lot more seriously than maybe they did in the 80s and 90s.
I really hope so, because, I mean, I'm not saying my SN was like ready to twist in half. Now, I did have a Fox body convertible that just jiggled like jello everywhere it went. And I didn't have any connectors on that. I mean, they definitely upped it through the 90s. And I have actually not had the chance to drive a newer Mustang convertible beyond my 95, but I've driven the newer Mustangs with the hard tops. And I've always felt that they felt just surprisingly buttoned down. And good grand tours too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it definitely fits the trim level for sure. That was kind of my abiding thought when we were driving, the coupe after lunch, was just like, this is a car that I would just love to take the scenic route everywhere I went. And I wouldn't necessarily need to be going 10 tenths. I wouldn't need to be going racetrack speeds, just like a brisk, enjoyable pace, you know, third or fourth gear the whole way. And enjoying the sound of the engine and the reasonably smooth ride and just kind of having a good time without feeling like I was lighting anyone else's hair on fire.
Well, here's a question that I'll ask that might not be on everybody's mind, but as somebody who's driven long distance in these cars, is this something that would be comfortable enough to jump in and, I mean, just take it for a 3 or 4 day trip covering several hundred miles? I mean, doing the GT thing, the grand touring thing.
Yeah, I think so. I didn't really have any major comfort complaints. The seat is a little bit high, and I feel like that's been a Mustang tradition since like forever. Like it just is always, I feel like I can never get low enough in a Mustang cockpit. So the seat's a little bit high. That might get a little tiresome after a while. The optional Recaro seats that you can get in the coupe are fantastic. They are, they're, you know, totally bolstered and well and supportive and everything like that. And there's still enough padding that you can kind of get comfortable. I could definitely see myself spending, you know, 5 or 6 hours pretty easily back there or, you know, in those seats. You know, not that it's a huge consideration for many Mustang shoppers, but it's incredible amount of trunk space in this thing. Even in the convertible, you get 10 cubic feet, which is a ton more than you get in even the coupe Camaro. So, you know, if you are one of those people who's going to take it on a long trip, like you can at least bring a lot of stuff with you. The only other thing that I might see getting a little bit tiresome is in the EcoBoost. It was an EcoBoost convertible. So obviously like sound deadening is not as good as it would be in a coupe, But and I wasn't sure if it was a weird like aero effect coming off of the roof or if it was the exhaust. But there was this really obnoxious like resonant thrum at like any speed above 55 or 60 that it sounded like wind buffeting against like, you know, an open window or something like that. And it was just really obnoxious. I'm not sure if it was because we had the top up or, you know, maybe it had the active exhaust on it. So it might have been, you know, triggered into some kind of like aggressive mode that we weren't intending, even though we had it set to normal. You know, it might have been doing like a full throttle, you know, active trigger or something. But otherwise, especially in the GT, like it was a pussycat. It was a great, comfortable, smooth, you know, just it felt like a great sports car. I don't really know what else to say. It was just very well-rounded and cohesive.
Can I ask one more question? Because I know we're 30 minutes in here. Was there anything that surprised you on your drives, either between the EcoBoost or the GT?
Yeah, of course. The EcoBoost. I've got two surprises to share. The EcoBoost is very, very nimble. You see the spec chart and you see 3,500 pounds, and you kind of wonder, you know, is this just kind of like a big, you know, it's not, you know, it's definitely not Miata size. So you kind of have to view it with some degree of skepticism. The EcoBoost is so incredibly nimble. We drove, all the ones that we drove had the high performance package. So it meant you got Pirelli P0 tires and stiffer anti-roll bars and a revised suspension setup. So obviously we were driving cars that were purpose-built for handling. But it did very, very well. We had an autocross course and then like a twisty road canyon drive, and it was so easy to control, and you felt a lot of like the suspension was very communicative. You definitely kind of just felt very in control of the car. And then the limits are pretty reasonably approached because it doesn't have the overwhelming power of the GT. So it really just feels very, very balanced and very comfortable. That was one really positive surprise that I had about the EcoBoost. The GT, you can call this one, you know, maybe a mixed blessing. It felt a little bit short on torque when you were down low in the rev range. Like if you were on the highway in fifth or sixth gear and you rolled onto the throttle, you didn't really feel much until the tach got to about 3000 RPM. So that was kind of a surprise on the negative side. The upswing to that though is the way that it screams from 3000 to 7000 is incredible. I mean, just like this brilliant rush of power and torque for that wide of a rev range. It's a bummer that you don't get it down low. But again, I kind of think that that's a, you know, a symptom of like a lot of Ford V8s. I know like the modular 4.6 V8 was similar. Like it screamed really, really well, but maybe was lacking some of the down low that you get in like an LS motor. And so it's kind of a mixed blessing. I found myself really enjoying it. It was a surprise, but I found myself just really enjoying that like high RPM thrill that you got in the GT.
So if I can chime in here one second. So Smith, thank you very much. You put up Cola's thing. New Mustang is not enough, in my opinion. It needs more power and more performance. And I was looking this up because Cola, I know you're a first time commenter, but that doesn't mean I can't push against you. The Aston Martin DB9, which I think we can all agree is kind of a benchmark, not in terms of style and performance. You know, it kind of combines both of those things. It had, let me look, double check this here. It had 450 horsepower and 420 pound-feet of torque. The Mustang that we're talking about now with a V8, 486 horsepower, which is more, 418 pound-feet of torque, which is a bit less. But still, saying that it doesn't have enough power, to me, is absurd. I can't co-sign with that.
Like Brett was just talking about, you know, the power peak, it feels like it's pretty high in this car. When you're in a big old American V8 like that, you tend to get used to just, it doesn't matter what gear I'm in, I'll just roll on the throttle, the torque will get me going, and then I'll really get pinned when it gets up in the range with a horsepower. Okay. So I mean, there might be a little something there. And keep in mind, like we said earlier, this is just the starting point. We still have Shelby's to come. The right. dark horse already, the dark horse already there is 500 horsepower. And as somebody who's driven plenty of 400, 500 horsepower cars, they're plenty fast. You get much beyond that. And I will argue this point to my grave. Unless you're talking about something weighing 5,000 pounds.
Yeah, unless you're talking about a semi truck.
when you start getting up into 500 horsepower or so, that sweet spot for me is 500 to 600 horsepower. That's a nice, good, usable amount for a street driven car. You'll still blow up the tires in first. If you have a good set of tires and a decent suspension, you'll be able to lay it down in second. You'll be able to enjoy the power. Anything beyond that.
My number's 300. That's where I put, and everyone can disagree. Like there's.
Well, anything beyond that. Right.
300 is my number. 500 sure is yours. Brett, I'm sure you have a different number than us, but.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
By law, 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know,
beyond that, your traction control is going to be constantly kicking in.
Yeah.
unless you turn it off, in which case you're just blowing the tires up because you're not getting traction. Or if you're in a Mustang, you're spinning
Yuri
out
says 700,
and crashing into crowds as you do in a Mustang. If you're at a track, hey. Go ahead, crank up the power where you can really, I mean, you get on some good straights, you could roll on it in third or fourth gear where you're really feeling that 700 horsepower. Below that on the street, you're just not feeling it. The traction control is going to cut in, or you're going to be modulating the throttle, or you might experience it for a second or two before you're doing ridiculously triple digit speeds that should not be undertaken on the street. So, I mean, that's kind of my point there. We've still got a ways to go with Mustang. We know there will be more powerful variants coming.
Of course, it's the new generation. There's going to be a Shelby. Like, if there's not a Shelby version, I would be shocked.
And Ford, if you're listening, and you better damn well be listening, you are fools. Fools, fools, fools. Did I say fools? I said fools. You are fools if you don't do an SVO.
Take that
EcoBoost. Brett, yeah. You were talking about how much lighter, nimbler it feels. You lose 250 pounds off the front.
You and I let's get an
SVO with 450 horse.
It doesn't need 400. It needs
and a 3,600 pound car with a much better weight distribution. That would be a tremendously fun Mustang.
And as long as it has the biplane spoiler.
Sure. Oh, there you go. Go yeah. Classic 80s with the biplane spoiler. There you go. I think that's just a no-brainer in my head. It really is. Turn that four-cylinder up a little bit. And I know people say Mustangs have to have V8. Well, yes, the V8 is known for the Mustang, but the Mustang, since its very, very, very beginnings, has always offered different engines.
It has.
It's an iconic factor that goes into the Mustang. But it's not a defining characteristic.
I mean,
so let's get a four-cylinder has been
a part of the Mustang formula for 20 years of the Mustang's existence. Like in
total. Oh, more than that. If the Fox body had a four-cylinder,
it was what the
oh yeah, you could
74
go
you, to 95 or 74 to 93, and then again from 2015 15 on, I think, something like that.
Okay. Then in that, yes. Yeah, the way you explained it, yes, you're right.
It's like 28 total years of the Mustang's 50-year history, it has offered a four-cylinder. So,
and six cylinders were around since the very beginning.
Yeah, literally since the very beginning.
Very beginning.
Yeah.
So lots of discussion there on the Mustang. We're 40 minutes in. We should probably move on to some of the other things we have to talk about.
Should.
But Brett, I mean, it's awesome that you had a chance to drive these. It's great to get this feedback. Yeah. I'm super excited to get behind the wheel of one here eventually. But for now, let's talk about another vehicle that has everybody pretty excited right now.
Smith, can I add one little bit more Mustang thing? Just super quick.
No! Yes. Okay, go.
To me, the Mustang, the beauty about the Mustang is that it can be all things to all people, and that it can be, you can build a Mustang as a track car. You can build a Mustang as a grand tour. You know, it can be a big V8 that just like takes you down the road at speed. You can pass cars and have no problems, and it can be comfortable, or it can be a track car with a super stiff suspension. You can be passing people all the time and whatever. And that's the beauty of it. And it's always been that way since literally day one, that you could outfit a Mustang to be whatever it is you want to be. So,
and now
that's all I had to say.
You can have it with four doors, room in the front to carry a bunch of shrimp to your cocktail parties, because that's what Mustang people do. When we go to Mustang meets, we fill
the shrimp guy.
We fill our trunks with shrimp, and we pop. This goes back to like media. It was like a media photo thing that Ford did when the Mach-E first came out. They were like, "Look at all the fun things you can do!" And one of them was like they filled the trunk with shrimp. Yep. And it's just like Ford. My God, there's not one single Mustang owner in the entire universe that is thinking, I'm going to fill my trunk with food, unless it's in a cooler.
Anyway. Well, that's the whole deal. It's a drainable, lockable trunk. It's a cooler. It's perfect.
Yeah, I still ain't putting shrimp in it.
Perfect for your raw meats and seafood.
Yeah.
Your raw meats and cheeses.
When we go to Carlisle or Mustang Week, that's exactly. Oh, my God, you found it, Bruce. You pulled it up right away. That's even the article I wrote too. Ford loses mind, fills Mustang Mach-E frunk with shrimp, because that's what Mustang people do.
Gross. Yeah, a Mustang can be everything. It can be a shrimp delivery device, or it can be a quarter mile pounder.
It can be everything, guys. Let's talk about the Land Cruiser teasers, because we're gonna run out of time. And we're called Rambling About Cars for a reason. We should call it Rambling Off the Rails About Cars. But Toyota Land Cruiser, you're like, well, a new one just came out a couple years ago. Well, yes, it's not sold in the United States unless you consider the Lexus variant, which is sold here. But the Land Cruiser name is coming back to North America, and it's been teased, and we got some pretty significant teasers on it today. And by pretty significant, okay, we're getting a flavor, a little bit of what it's going to look like. I want to stress nothing is confirmed at this point. Right. But it's most likely going to be based on the Lexus GX, which is what Brett was alluding to earlier, which means it's going to be a little bit smaller. And I think that makes sense, to go with the, just the history of the Land Cruiser, its capabilities. You could certainly do a lot more with something a little bit smaller. And we just got quite a few pictures that we added into the post. And Brett, you actually wrote this up. Can you tell us a little bit about why this is kind of a big deal here?
Yeah. So a lot of these photos were found, you know, overnight while I was fast asleep. But before I wrote the post to one specific teaser that Toyota themselves released under embargo, and you can kind of see there's definitely some like retro design cues, especially up front. You get a tiny little hint of it in that headlight view, but then the front end has like a very, you know, kind of traditional blocky square grille with the retro Toyota word mark instead of the Jelly Bean logo. So you definitely are seeing some kind of like a return to like old school Toyota, you know, off-roading goodness, which is fun. That's always good to see. And then these next teasers that Bruce up there found and added to the gallery, these were posted on Toyota's Japanese website and kind of like talking about the 2024 Land Cruiser. And you can definitely see a ton more detail in there, which is awesome. And I would have, you know, I am really happy that he spotted these in time. One feature that I really love is the taillight. I don't know if this is
real quick, full credit, because I'm going to take credit for something that's on. Adrian, our boss, found them. And then I was kind of the one that said, we really got to put these on the site.
We really should. And it seemed like everybody wanted to see them. So good team effort.
Yeah. The first thing that you can clearly tell though, is that it's definitely going to be a smaller vehicle than the, the last time we had a Land Cruiser sold here was the 200 series. And that was a big Sequoia base, not Sequoia base, but it was Sequoia sized and, you know, had a big, 5.7 liter V8. It was just a kind of a hulking machine. And you can tell just from these photos alone that this is going to be a much smaller, more accessibly sized off-roader, which is definitely befitting the Land Cruiser's brand history and heritage here.
And one thing that came in with these teasers, aside from the outside, we got one glimpse of the center console where we were able to see some four-wheel drive controls. And I know we were talking about that a little bit just in our chat here today about what some of those could mean, just to some of the various locking differentials, some of the features that might be available on there, which I don't know that a lot of other news outlets picked up on, but I felt like that was a pretty significant little teaser here.
I don't know that a lot of other news outlets realized that there were additional photos on the Japanese press site. Or not Japanese press site, Japanese promo site, I should say.
Yeah. But, go ahead.
We've got H4F, and we talked about this in our chat, and we're not 1,000% sure what these various things mean, but we've kind of got a speculation. H4F might be high four-wheel drive full-time for full-time all-wheel drive. H4L, we're thinking is high range four-wheel drive with a locking center differential, which is something that the Lexus GX has. And then L4L for low range four-wheel drive with the locking center differential. And again, we're not sure. This is the image we have, but I could pull up the image from the Lexus GX, and it only has two options. It has H4 and L4. Mm-hmm. Whereas it looks like this is going to have that additional H4L option.
Right.
And the difference here is that the Lexus, it does have the two options, but it has a button that you can press for the locking center differential.
Yes.
It could just be that Toyota is doing without that button, and it's just kind of letting you choose between, you know, whether you want your traditional like all-wheel drive style, full-time four-wheel drive, or if you want that locked center differential to kind of like... Mm-hmm. preempt traction loss before it happens.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, but we don't know yet for sure, but we definitely have this image and we have this, you know, nomenclature, these letterings, and we just have to kind of go off of that. So we don't know, but we've all been writing about cars for a while.
From the Japanese website. So, you know, even if we are conjecturing right now, it is about a Japanese product that, you know, Toyota has announced, they've officially announced that there is a new Land Cruiser coming and it will be revealed on August 1st. Mm-hmm. And if it has anything to do with this Japanese car that we're talking about right here, great. But, you know, we do need to kind of clarify that these are taken from the Japanese, not the USA website.
Totally. Yep.
Right.
Very good point to make.
But it's also nice to know that we don't have long to try to figure this out. It'll be displayed, well, August 1st, it is what? July 26th right now. So
we're recording. We're
just a few days away. And Cola comments, new Land Cruiser Prado is going to be an excellent vehicle, better than the Wrangler plus Bronco. Upcoming 4Runner and this Land Cruiser Prado are going to be good.
I don't know. They all appeal to different buyers, I think. And that's what's glorious about them, is that each one of them does slightly different things, and that's perfectly okay. And they're all going to appeal to a different buyer. And I think there are plenty of buyers for them all. That's my opinion. I don't know, but yeah.
Now, I feel like I'm getting some deja vu, Bruce. Didn't we have a very similar discussion when the Lexus GX debuted?
Yes, because we
were so surprised, pleasantly, I might add, at the styling direction Lexus took with their GX, how it's just kind of chunky. And I think I was talking about, are you going for this or like a Wrangler Unlimited? Or I think I even mentioned G-Class in there. Maybe we talked Bronco too, because are we really comparing Wrangler and Bronco to Lexus? But it was just the GX just kind of had that vibe going on, right?
Sure. No, yeah, you're right. And I think, we know it's a new Land Cruiser. We're assuming it's related to the Prado, GX. Damn if it doesn't look like it. The evidence just keeps piling up and up and up and up.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be some pretty obvious connections between the two. Like that belt line right there, you can see very clear upkick on the on the rear mm-hmm. passenger door. It's gonna be a GX.
Yeah, I think it's pretty safe to make that generalization. That's one of those things where it's like, it's not confirmed, but I mean, we have eyes.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of, my Jeep nomenclature. I want to say it's JK Cherokee, but maybe that's
XJ.
The wrong
nomenclature. XJ.
Oh, maybe it is XJ. It kind of reminds me of that, where it's not quite as luxurious as the Grand Cherokee that sits above it, but it has every bit of the off-road chops. And so, hey, I don't mind if I have to sit in cloth seats. I don't care about that, but I still have all of those mechanicals underneath me that, I can still do rock crawling and stuff like that. It feels like that's what this vehicle's going to be. And
that's my biggest question, is where they're going to be positioning it. Cause we don't have pricing on the GX yet either. So we don't know if the GX is going to be like ostensibly going to be cheaper than the LX, which starts at 80 some odd $1,000. So, GX maybe somewhere in the 60s or 70s, it's probably going to compete right at the Defender 110, 130 market. Is this going to be a Defender 90 price, 50 to 70, or is this going to be, more like a Jeep or a Bronco, like 40 to 60? I'm dying to see where they're going to position this and how they're going to differentiate it from 4Runner and Sequoia TRD Pro. I'm dying to see where this car sits in their lineup.
Agreed.
Well, we won't have long to wait.
Right.
We won't have long to wait. And let me just give a quick shout out to Ted Adam Green, who commented on the same thing that I noticed. Why do foreign market cars have English words on their car? Since we were saying that, yes, this is a Japanese market car. I haven't been in many Japanese market cars, and by that I mean zero. But I believe the writing is still generally the same across the board.
I can kind of answer this. And Ted Adam Green, have you ever heard of lingua franca, which was during the 17th and 16th century when French was considered the language of the world? That's why it's lingua, language, franca, French. That was the accepted language of everything in the world. These days, English, for now at least, don't know how long that's going to last, is the language of the world. So you would still put things in English. I taught school in Germany. My students in, not great English whatsoever, but they could communicate, they could say, can I go to the bathroom or, something, they couldn't have a philosophical conversation with me, but they could express very simple things in English with me. So that's why it's in English, is that it's the lingua franca of the modern world.
Well, and to that end, that's kind of a fairly recent development in Japanese cars, at least, because I know someone who has a 1994 Toyota Celsior, which is the Lexus LS of our, we got it as the LS, they got it as a Toyota Celsior, and his car, all of the buttons the traction control button, everything is all in Japanese lettering. Mm. And really, it's really kind of funny to watch. So I had no idea how to operate anything at all. I've got no idea how any of that works. So I think it is kind of a recent development for Japanese market cars, but I was surprised by the same thing. I was there a couple of months ago with Honda, and all of the cars that they ferried us around in had the radio dials were all in, American, in English, lettering and everything like that. Like used the same markings as our American market Hondas do. It's very weird.
Well, that might be a good segue since we're speaking about the Japanese market there. Let's talk here just briefly on the Mitsubishi L200, the Triton, depending on which market you're in, because that just debuted today. And I think it's a pretty significant vehicle that could have a place in North America if Mitsubishi decides to bring it here, because we're talking about, it's a mid-sized truck, but it's got a new ladder frame underneath it. I feel like a lot of truck people are going to take it a lot more seriously. Not that the previous one was sketchy, but I feel like truck people are going to take this more seriously because it's got that ladder frame underneath it. It's a pretty sizable truck. I think it has decent looks. I don't know that I would call it attractive, yeah. It's
rugged. It's burly.
Yeah. It has a real burly truck look. The new truck, it has a couple different four-wheel drive systems that you can choose from. One of them has 7 drive modes, center locking diffs that can actually do a 60-40 split to the front and rear wheels if you need it, or run it just two-wheel drive or run it four-wheel drive. There's a new 2.4-liter diesel engine. It's the only engine that Mitsubishi is talking about now.
It's available in 3 tunes.
Right. It's like the Chevrolet Colorado. It's available in 3 tunes. It starts at 148 horsepower, 243 pound-feet. You can get the mid-tune, which is 181 horsepower, 316 pound-feet. Or the top tune here is 201 horsepower, 346 pound-feet. It uses a 6-speed auto or a 6-speed manual shift by wire transmission, and I would like to know a little bit more about that. Well, you didn't get a lot of information from Mitsubishi on that. I mean, it's a regular 3-pedal setup with the lever in the middle, but apparently it's electronically connected electronically. Would like to know a little bit more about that. But the point is, automatic or manual, 6-speed is there. The interior is wonderfully analog. Did you guys notice that? We don't have Mitsubishi. They didn't offer details on the size of the touchscreen, the center. And I believe just that driver is still analog gauges. But it's a wonderfully analog interior. And I can't help but wonder if we're seeing that with American brands, Ford, General Motors, Ram, where they're still offering a lot of analog controls, because I think truck buyers are appreciating that a lot more. So we're seeing that in this truck. And of course, we're looking at it now. Bruce, you wrote up the article.
Yes, but I was just
on the rally version.
Yep. They're not only they announced the street version today, but they also announced the rally version. And I got to pull it up so I can get the correct name of the rally it's competing in. The Asia Cross Country Rally that runs from Thailand to Laos, and it starts in August. And apparently there are a lot of river crossings and water crossings during that event. And that's why it has that snorkel that goes all the way to the roof. Like sometimes we see it just stops at the A pillar. No. This one goes all the way to the roof just in case. So apparently it's going through some fairly deep water from time to time. So they have a street version, and they also have this rally version that if you're watching on YouTube that we're seeing now, that is rugged. It has the rally version has a different suspension setup. It has dual dampers front and back. It also gains limited slip differentials at the front and back, whereas the standard version only has a limited slip differential in the middle. So, bunch of extra parts. The powertrain is actually the same. It's still the same 2.4 liter turbo diesel. It just has a bunch of extra parts for making sure that power goes down to the right place.
And as Group FBC points out, Nissan underneath, there's strong family ties here to the Nissan Navara. Yeah. And it is on sale. Can you guys believe this? An automaker debuts a vehicle that you can buy right now, not in a year and a half. Are you listening, Hyundai? It's available right now. It's on sale in Thailand, and it goes on sale Southeast Asia a little bit later. And it will also be offered in Japan in 2024. And it wouldn't look out of place in North America.
So that's exactly what I was about to say, is that obviously Mitsubishi has a presence in the United States. I understand there's the chicken tax that's going to add 25% to this vehicle's price. And I'm going to be PG here and say it's bullpucky that the chicken tax still exists in the year of our Lord 2023, because it shouldn't. But assuming it didn't exist, this seems like a fine truck to sell here. It seems like for a lot of people, this would fulfill their needs. Not everyone. Mm-hmm. Some people need a Ford 2500 or Silverado 24. You know, there are people that need a bigger truck, but if it weren't for the bullpucky chicken tax, this seems like it would work, right?
I mean, I feel like I have to wonder if we're seeing, maybe I should put this a different way. This truck feels like it could fit in the North American market right now, and it's designed for markets not North America. But I wonder if that's in the backs of their minds, you know, people at Nissan, designers at Mitsubishi, thinking, you know, if we want to take it over there, if we suddenly hear, hey, we have to have this, is it plug and play ready to go? I don't know. That's just pure 100,000% speculation.
Yeah.
But I feel like this truck could fit in right now in North America.
Well, Mitsubishi hasn't sold a truck here in forever, and they desperately need.
But they did. That's the thing. They have before.
I almost bought one, guys.
They just need something to sell that people are actually going to buy, though, and Americans buy trucks. So, like, this would be a very easy way for them to try for some market share if it's something they wanted to do.
Yeah. And I just wonder if that's in the backs of their minds as they're going forward. But, yeah, the Mitsubishi Triton.
How much What's does that? The existing Frontier share with the Navara? Do you guys know?
Oh, boy. I don't know off the top of my head.
Sorry.
Because I'd be curious to see if they could adapt the North American plant in Mississippi that builds the Frontier to also build a truck for Mitsubishi, you know, using, as Kola pointed out, that. excuse me. Sorry. sorry about that. As Kola pointed out, that the L200 has Mitsubishi engineering in it. I wonder if they could integrate some of that into the facility in Mississippi to build Mitsubishi a truck.
Yeah, no, but Brett, this is a discussion you and I have never had. So if you disagree with me, I'm happy to have this discussion with you. To me, it feels like we are past the point where saying foreign market built pickup trucks shouldn't be offered in the United States. Because that's essentially the way the law works now, because of the chicken tax that Eisenhower imposed, that you have to add 25% to their value, and it just makes it prices them out of the market.
Yeah,
I feel like we're past that, to me. And if someone wants to disagree with me and give me an argument against that, I'll listen to them. But
yeah,
I'm not there.
We should be totally past that, but. To keep it rambling about cars,
we're rambling.
Yeah, okay, rambling about cars as opposed to
deal.
Topics other than cars. We'll just say, Mitsubishi, we really hope that that this truck works for you and it works well enough that you'll offer it in North America. Because, yeah, guys, I was very close to buying a Mighty Max back in the 90s. I found a little one at the dealership actually that I worked at. It was just a little two-wheel drive, five-speed manual truck, and it was just a blast to drive. So that's my Mitsubishi story.
So I think if it's okay with you, Smith, we will skip our S2000 story and go to our $1 million challenge story. Is that okay?
Well, let's just touch on it really quick because something worth mentioning. We can just spend a minute or two on it. The long story short is, okay, we've heard another rumor, and this time this report comes from Car Magazine in the UK, which is a fairly reputable source. It's why we looked into it, and unfortunately we haven't been able to get anything from Honda beyond we're excited for the future, you know, and I understand that stuff, but I mean the report here is that Honda is planning something for its 75th anniversary, and it could be some sort of S2000. And here's where it's a little interesting, because we're hearing S2000 revival or S2000 successor. So it may be an S2000. It may just be a spiritual successor to the S2000. Don't know on those fronts, but they're saying that they have sources in their side of the industry that are saying it's happening, and it will be electric. And that's pretty much the extent of the rumor. But anytime we hear rumors about S2000, they capture our attention. And I think they capture the attention of a lot of people. And in fact, I know they do, because the reason we're talking about it is we were watching our traffic numbers on this article blow up today. That's the crux of the rumor. Like I said, there's not a whole lot there. But if I could, I would like to just spark a very short discussion. Does an S2000 make sense as an EV? And I'm not saying this.
Yes.
I'm not saying this to be a detractor of EVs, because I'm not. But one of the defining characteristics of the S2000 was that just gloriously high revving, naturally aspirated four-cylinder engine. Do you lose that gloriousness? Did I say that right? Do you lose that appeal if you go with an electric S2000?
No, because an electric motor revs to umpteen thousand RPM.
But it's not same, Bruce. You know, it's not the same.
If I were a marketing person, I bet I could spin it to be the same thing. As long as you keep the weight down and you keep it to be a engaging vehicle to drive, something, you know, what if, and we know nothing about this, this is totally on Chris Bruce right now. What if you did an EV with a stupid, insane red line and a manual transmission? You know, what if you did something like that? That would still be engaging to drive. That would be a proper successor to the S2000. You know, it's.
But you don't really have red line with an EV. So, it just spins faster.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I can't fight you there.
It just spins faster.
I've heard from more than one person, though, that I've never driven an S2000, so this is purely like third-hand information. But my brother owned one for a little while, and then a friend of mine has had like very nice. He had a S2000 CR for a little while, which is like both of these people said that like the high RPM screaming is a little bit overrated, and that like when you're just kind of trying to use it like a car, it's a pain in the butt because there's not.
It's a total pain. I have had the pleasure of driving them, and I almost bought one, and instead what we were talking about earlier, I bought an 03 SVT Cobra. But I was cross shopping those two because I wanted just a fun to drive small convertible, and they're like opposite ends of the spectrum. The S2000 does not make sense as just a drive me around car, because you really have to get it up there to really enjoy it. But man, I enjoyed it every time.
So you did have a good time just like screaming it up to red line.
I was addicted as hell to that red line. I just wanted to stay. I just wanted to go from like 5 to 8,500 constantly. That's all I wanted. Slow back down. Then, you know, just constantly. I loved it. So I that's why I'm asking, because I could be a little colorblind here.
I mean, that's what people say, that they say that just like revving that thing to, you know, high heaven is a really enjoyable experience. Two of the people that I know who have actually owned them have said that it's like, eh, like
you get nice tired of it after a while.
Yeah, exactly. And so I kind of think that an EV would solve that problem, you know, perfectly. To Chris Bruce's point, if they can keep the weight down and if they can maintain it as like a lightweight, enjoyable roadster feel, with all of a sudden now you've got instantaneous torque.
Yeah. Well, real quick, I want to say, Cola, I've agreed with you tonight. I've disagreed with you tonight. And now I'm back on your side tonight. Mustang Mach-E haters are ignorant because the Mustang is not just one vehicle. Smith, you will agree with this because you are a Mach-E lover.
I didn't agree with it at first when I wrote that inflammatory Ford loses mind, fills frunk with shrimp. I didn't agree then, but you know, after I drove one,
stupid.
That was a very stupid PR thing. I still stand by
vehicle.
But yeah, I am totally on board. And in fact, Cola, since you are a new listener to Rambling About Cars, you are talking to one of six people in the world who love the Mustang II.
You're not wrong.
There's six of us. We're the few. We're the proud. And yes, I am just fine with an electric four-door Mustang crossover. After driving one, it can make sense. It's a different experience, but you know what? Driving a 73 Mach 1 is a very different experience from driving a 78 Mustang II Cobra, which is very different from driving a 90 LX 5-liter convertible, which, Brett, is very, very, very different from driving a 2024. So yeah, lots of room in that universe. Are we ready for the cheap car challenge now, guys?
I was waiting for Brett to respond to that. He didn't. So
no, I've been fine with the GT with the Mach-E since the beginning. I don't really think there's anything wrong with it at all. A name is just a name, you know?
Yep.
Holy crap, guys. Cola, I love the Mustang II as well. Okay, seven. Welcome to the family. There you go.
So the rule,
cheap car challenge time. And yeah, this is a very, very different cheap car challenge. Bruce, you were about to explain it, so I'll shut up. Cheap
car challenge ever like this in 134
episodes.
Generally, the cheap car challenge is supposed to be for a car that anyone could conceivably own. It's generally $1,000, $5,000. I think we pushed it maybe to $10,000 once, but that was like a one-time thing. This time, the cheap car challenge is for $1 million.
$1 million. A million isn't much money these days, right?
And that is because we are looking at the cars, all of the cars, for sale at this year's Monterey Car Week. So that
there
means
are
RM
many
Sotheby's,
options.
That means Goodings. That means Meekum. That means, what else am I missing? There's one I'm particularly missing.
Bonhams,
that's the one.
Bonhams. Yeah. I mean, there are a plethora of auctions. And of course, mid-August on the Monterey Peninsula, $1 million is a cheap car.
Sadly, it is.
I mean, if you look through those auction listings, I mean, you'll find lots of cars for $100,000 and up. You don't really see much under $100,000.
There are a handful, but
there are a handful. So that's sort of the context for this cheap car challenge. $1 million.
My favorite thing about this cheap car challenge was, usually when you do these challenges, you have a slider on your classified ad that your classified page that you can like limit how high you want the price to go. With this one, it was like $50,000. $40 million. And so like to slide it down to like get the maximum to $1 million, you had like this much of the bar was available to you. It was insane. It was so depressing.
I want to call out our buddy Groupa FBC here. This is the cheap car challenge for Zuckerberg, Elon, and Bezos when they're all drunk texting. And bravo, man.
Yep. And then, exactly right. And then the next morning, one of them was like, wait, I bought an Alpha. What? Why did I pay that? What, did I really do? How do you think I feel? I bought some weird Isuzu I'd never heard of. You know, so.
But the other funny thing is we've looked at this list. There are cars. There was specifically a Jaguar C-Type I wanted. It was selling for $3 million. And I had to cut it out of this list because I'm like, oh, I can't afford that according to the rules. So
right.
No, well, Jag C-Type for me.
And speaking of the rules, we discussed this ahead of time. The vehicle, it's any one vehicle under $1 million.
Yes.
But it's just one vehicle. And obviously yes.
we have to pick one.
It's under $1 million. Cause otherwise, you know, cause Bruce and I were discussing this, I would just find every 80s car that was selling for 50 or 60 grand and buy like, and buy like a gazillion. Yep. So I promise I obeyed the rules. Would you guys like me to go first?
If you want to, yeah. Please. If you're all set, I'm okay. Ready
for it. Well, let me see if my screen share is gonna work this time, because last time it didn't work very well. So, like I said, I followed the rules. This is a 72 Ferrari 365 GTS 4 Daytona Spider. Yeah. It is one of two black with the tan leather. And if anybody grew up in the 80s, you know Miami Vice.
This is
the car that Sonny Crockett drove. And I didn't know there was actually only two legit cars made like this. Now
in black, you have to say, because they made multiple convertibles. Well, not multiple. They made, I think, literally a dozen convertibles. But in black, two.
Two. Now, it does have an estimated range of 2.8 to 3.2 million. But hold on. I know we said 1 million.
No.
When this auction starts, the first thing I'm going to say, holy crap, Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas are outside. It's a Miami Vice reunion. Everybody is going to be bidding on this car. They're bidding on this car because it's Crockett's car. They're out, man. They're out to see the Miami Vice reunion. I'm throwing my bid down. I'm stealing this car for $1 million.
Is there a reserve on this auction, Chris? Because your $1 million might not get you that car if they've got a reserve going.
I didn't look that close. Come on, guys.
Get out of here.
Okay. Somebody else go then. I'll find another pick.
Sheesh. Okay. Well, no.
That's a perfectly good plan, but that's okay. That's okay. I'm a team player here. You guys go ahead.
Mine is well within is an academic statement. Mine is within the price range. And that is a paint to sample 993 911 Porsche Turbo S.
Oh, that's this so boring and predictable.
No, it's not.
Well, that's kind of rad.
This man had it paint to sampled to the, let me pull it up here. Oh, the 917 and 935 that he owned. Estimated value is $750,000 to $950,000. So theoretically, my million will buy this car. It's a paint to sample 993 911 Turbo S. Fight me. Like,
I like these cars. I don't understand why they're $1 million cars.
Well, exactly. No, the normal ones aren't. It's that this one is paint to sample. That's not, those aren't stickers. That's paint.
And I saw this car too, and I thought, oh, that's pretty neat. But it's like, I don't see the price for this. If I were to buy that car,
come on. No,
I would constantly, Dude, you're arguing for a $1 million 993?
Yes.
Man.
With 90s graphics on it.
You know how loath I am to agree with Christopher Smith after he besmirched the 959 a couple weeks ago, but
did you see there's one for sale that's going for about $1 million? I almost picked it just to flip you a finger.
I saw it.
I would do for $1 million. I'd happily do a 959. That tracks to me. That feels, you know, in the realm of billionaire appropriate.
I gotta say this again. Those aren't stickers. Porsche painted those colors on
there. Well, I could paint a poop emoji on there, but it's still not. It doesn't make it worth that much money.
I'm not saying that, like, it's neat. Isn't best. Yeah, it's neat. It's not.
I love the blue.
It's not tripling the value neat, though. I don't totally.
Okay. I can respect that opinion. I can respect that. I'm not still. If I was going to maximize my fantastical $1 million, this is the one I think I would get. And there, I do have a second example. I do have a backup, but I think I would go with this.
Group FBC is nailing it again. I'm getting Sunoco vibes.
Why is that a bad thing?
It's the Sunoco 911 because it's not a Golf 911, is it? It's a Sunoco 911. That's the 911 you get when you can't afford the Golf.
Thank goodness.
But
it's
this
not
man could have. It's paint. It's not stickers. Damn it! Some Porsche. Some poor German in Zuffenhausen, like, set it all out and put all that paint on and made it look perfect in 1996, probably. You know.
And I'll give you like $300,000 for it. $20 best I can do.
Okay.
Well, Ted Adam Green's on your side. I feel you, Bruce. Paint to sample stripes. The stripes are cool. I dig it.
Yeah.
I just, man, it feels like a lot.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, not besmirching the car one little bit. Cool car, neat spec, very interesting choice that the guy made to have it match his race cars. Can't fault that one bit.
Okay. Next person's up.
Brett, I think that's you. You sent us the link. Bruce, do you have it? Or if not, I have it right here.
It's just in private chat. I can also try and present, but if you guys
No. I got it right here, man.
You got it right there? Okay. Oh. Take her away. I saw this
you
car,
went
too.
Bigger, went home, man.
And I was tempted, man, because this thing is hot.
This was
Tell us what it is, Brett.
Like, seat of the pants, 1938 Bugatti Type 57 Roadster in the style of Gangloff. I don't know what any of those words mean. This was
a beauty.
When I scrolled past it, it made a funny feeling happen in the base of my belly, and I decided I needed to get it.
In the base of your pants, I think you mean, but
sure.
Yeah.
I was trying to keep it family appropriate, but yeah. Something
that's
funny.
That's still PG-13. There are a lot of things in your pants.
And it just, yep. So I don't know what it is. It's the 30. I think it has the straight eight end of the Bugatti straight eight. So, you know, it's going to make an absolute insane 1930s Grand Prix scream. But I just like really love the vents all over the hood. I think it just looks so, so bitchin'.
You're not wrong. It's also the vent. I can't imagine these are functional. I have to imagine these are just a stylistic thing because the vent along the side sills match the vents along the hood.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And for an estimated selling price of $300,000 less than that 911 turbo.
And guess who's going to just get all the attention. It's not the Sunoco.
There's gonna be someone in the back corner of the Cars and Coffee going, but they're painted. They're not paint.
If you have to explain your car, and that just speaks for itself. I saw that car and I was very tempted, just because I'm a huge fan of the 30s. That whole pre-war era of automotive design is just flamboyant and extravagant. And I love every single aspect of it. The fenders, the racing cockpit that I am building right now is going to be styled in this manner once it's all said and done. So, yep. Bravo. That's a great choice. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I got to sit, I wasn't a Bugatti, it was a Tabo Lago last year. I got to sit in one at Pebble Beach, and it was like, just one of those like top 10 pinch me, this isn't actually happening moments of my life.
I remember you talking about that.
Fabulous, fabulous cars.
Now,
I feel like I lost here, if I'm honest. Like, I feel like you guys both picked better than me.
Well, I do have something that actually fits within the rules.
I want to see guys, Smith's rule following choice.
If you guys can permit me,
go ahead. Yeah,
and we're here. And I'm actually torn. So there's going to be some quick fire things here. We're going to start with the Toyota 2000 GT because damn, I've always loved these cars.
Well, that's gotta be 1 million. Exactly.
They don't come up as estimate of 800,000 to 1 million. So it's right there. It's a 67 Toyota 2000 GT. It fits the rules. It's red. I love red. I am scared to death to buy one and drive one because I feel like I would love it right away. And then I would be really sad because it's a Toyota. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but when this car came out, it wasn't necessarily designed to be the super awesome, extravagant thing. It was designed to just be a fun sports car, and it's epic. And I'm scared to buy it because I'm afraid. I mean, what do they say? Don't meet your heroes, right?
Smith, you and I have had this discussion before. Is that, 3 years after this, 4 years after this, the Datsun 240Z arrives, and it's basically the same idea for
it's very a similar
fraction of the price.
But I love the way the 2000 GT looks. The styling is better. It's got the right sounds. But I'm scared to death that I would get just either bored or just a little tired of it too quick. So what I did find was my legit dream car.
Okay.
A 1935 Auburn 851 goddamn boat tail speedster that is gorgeous. Look at this thing.
Just
look at it.
Are those supercharged as well?
That is a supercharged Lycoming straight 8 engine, 2-seater.
Straight 6, okay.
And this is at Mecum, which I apologize. I forgot to send you guys the link to Mecum. How many Ferraris did you guys go through?
Oh, pages
and
pages.
On these dozens? Auction links. How many Auburns? I found two.
A handful?
Yeah.
And this is the only boat tail speedster I found.
Go to the money shot. Show the boat tail.
It's 650,000 to 800,000 estimate. Yeah. I honestly thought it was going to be higher. Inline 8-cylinder. It's just such the presence of this car is just gorgeous. My racing cockpit is actually going to be based on an Auburn boattail speedster because I sort of have that slant up by the cockpit already. I'm going to build just a little boattail back. I was trying to source some actual Auburn parts, like an Auburn supercharge badge or something. And just those parts alone are just ridiculously expensive.
Well out of your price range.
But, it's
a fantastic looking car.
Yeah, it's just the sleek back. This is black with red. It fits the bill. The hood ornaments. This is legit one of my dream cars. So I was happy to find it for well under $1 million. The pipes on the side and everything.
Those coiled pipes are such a mood. I love the look of those coiled pipes on everything that they're in. It kills me.
And I'm buying flex pipe to put on the racing cockpit. So I will have a front with the pipes coming out. It's probably going to look like the worst Ferrari Fiero body kit you've ever seen, but damn it, it's going to be mine. And in fact, this is at such a bargain. I know we're only supposed to pick one, but that leaves me room to buy this 1999.
No. We got
I'm not breaking the rules, but it leaves me enough to buy this 99 Ferrari 550 Maranello for 200 to 250 grand.
Okay.
This is the
which is also, I'm just saying, theoretically, if we could, I theoretically have enough money left over from the Auburn to buy this 99 Ferrari 550 Maranello, which I've always loved my entire life. So I could have something newer with a V12 that I know I wouldn't get tired of, with the Auburn Bowtail that I know I would never get tired of.
My friend.
I have a Tour Show project car in the garage. Bring it. I'm not scared. What's it going to do? Oh, am I going to scrape my fingers trying to change a crankshaft position sensor? Oh, guess what? I've been there.
Okay.
What are your picks, Brett, everybody? Podcast at MotorOne.com.
This show, or it'll go on forever. Brett, please. Where can folks follow you? Brett, take us out of this damn show.
The stripes are painted, though. Come on.
That might be my new Twitter bio. I think the stripes are painted.
I'm sorry. I thought it was cool. I still think it's cool.
Some Stuttgarter craftsman has just been spending hours and hours just painting those three stripes. It's gorgeous.
It's a thing of beauty. I hope he's retired now and he's in some bar in Stuttgart and he's drinking his masa and he's like, I had to paint these damn stripes every day.
I want him to hear the podcast. I hope he comes across this podcast someday and he thinks Chris Bruce is the only man in that room with some taste.
Right. Yes.
I'm the only man that appreciates you, Mr. Porsche painter.
Paint a spec. Brett, what do you have going on? You got the Lexus LX project that you're writing about at Motor One. Plus you're plugging just constant content into MotorOne.com. What do you got going on?
Well, you should definitely go check out the Mustang GT review that just published yesterday. Mm-hmm. There's a video to go along with that as well. And then next week, you're going to see my colleague, our friend, Jeff Perez's review of the Dark Horse going live. So be sure to check that out. I'm on Twitter, Threads, and Instagram as Brett_T_Evans. So if you want to check in there, feel free.
You're
by all means.
You're a Threadser now, right? You're on Threads, right?
Very intermittently, but yeah, same handle, pretty much the same content.
Right, so. Because Threads and Instagram are kind of sort of children. Yeah,
And exactly. I'm there now as well, Hunter VF, V-E-E-F. And by the way, you can catch all of those links to everything that Brett just talked about right in the YouTube description of this very podcast. They're there right now, along with links to the other stuff we talked about here on this episode.
Yep. All good things.
Yep. I will say, all the socials, well, not all the socials, most of the socials, I am Auto Writer, AutoWriter 227. That's Twitter, Instagram, Threads. So if anyone wants to follow me, but yeah, we always love getting any comments to Motor One, Motor One.com on YouTube, Motor One.com on Twitter, Motor One.com Instagram, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Very cool.
The only different one is Motor One
YouTube.
Full stop on YouTube and TikTok.
Oh, you're right.
Yep. Yeah, we're on TikTok as well.
Yeah. But yeah, we love getting all your comments. I just like comments, honestly. I look at emails all the time.
Email podcast at MotorOne.com.
And emails.
Don't forget, we've got the emails. We love getting the emails.
Yep. All that's fun stuff. We're going to sign off now. Brett, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I hope we didn't take up too much of your time.
No, this was an awesome conversation.
Yeah. But otherwise, good afternoon, good morning, because I know Grupa FBC, he's in Australia and it's morning time for him. And I hope we have other Australian or New Zealander or whatever is in that time zone listeners. So good afternoon, good morning, good evening, or good night these days. We really appreciate the fact that you guys decide to spend time with us, because you could do it in so many different ways. You could watch movies or video games or who the hell knows what. You could be spending time with family or human beings. No. Like, what crazy people are that? We love it. I just appreciate it so much, and we're going to be signing off. So bye-bye, everybody.
Take care. We'll see you.
Have a good night.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.